Big welcome to the Heritage Council podcast, and a theme that we are embracing for this series in 2021 is inclusive heritage. This will involve a broad overview of the multi-layered experiences which encompass Ireland's past, and will also put into context how this sense of heritage is all about our collective experience, and why so much of what went before still resonates in the present. I hope you enjoy the show. Currently, one-third of our 98 wild beast species are threatened with extinction. In order to ensure the sustainability of our food, avoid additional economic impacts on agriculture, and protect environmental health, we need to take care of our pollinators. Last week, the National Biodiversity Data Centre published a report, Working Together for Biodiversity, which highlighted what has been achieved through the All-Ireland Pollinator Plan in its first 5 years. In publishing the plan back in September 2015, Ireland became one of the first countries in Europe to address this critical issue. The implementation of the plan was coordinated by the National Biodiversity Data Centre, which is a programme of the Heritage Council. This plan was a collaboration between the Heritage Council, Biodiversity Ireland, Borbia, the Irish Food Board, and the Department of Agriculture, Food and the Marine, and it is supported by more than 100 governmental and non-governmental organisations. The plan identifies 81 actions to make Ireland more pollinator-friendly. In today's podcast, we chat with Project Manager Dr. Una Fitzpatrick, a senior ecologist in the National Biodiversity Data Centre, who explains the background to what is a landmark development. We also chat with Lorcan Scott, the wildlife officer with the Heritage Council, about his work. And finally, we also talk with the dairy farmer, John Fogarty, who's making small changes that are making a big difference to biodiversity on his farm in Tipperary. I hope you enjoy the show. Dr. Una Fitzpatrick, a big welcome to the Heritage Council podcast. How are you keeping?
Good. Thanks very much for chatting to me today.
Oh, you're so welcome. And you're from the National Biodiversity Data Centre. And what I'd like to do is for you to help me to join a whole load of dots. That's okay.
Sounds good.
So this morning, I was walking our dogs first thing in the morning, getting a bit of fresh air and giving them a bit of exercise. I walked past a little patch, and I'm living in Ballincollig in Cork. So there's a little green area where I live, and there's a little patch, and there's a lovely little sign with a picture of a bee. And the sign says Ballincollig Pollinator Corridor. So I need you to join that dot. I need you to join the dots between the National Data Centre and the Heritage Council. And I also know there's a report that came out this week, which is called Working Together for Biodiversity. And that's basically the five-year progress report from the work of the All-Ireland Pollinator Plan. Now, that's a lot of words and a lot of things and entities. So I'm going to throw the ball to you now to help me to join the dots.
I'll do my best. I think this story starts maybe within the National Biodiversity Data Centre itself. And, you know, what we do there is we track changes in Ireland's wildlife. So we know where things occur and how they're changing. So we've known for quite some time that pollinators, and particularly our bees, are in difficulty. So within the data centre, we know that one third of our 98 wild bee species are threatened with extinction. You know, that's a frightening figure. What we also know is that our common species, or common bumblebees, the things that you see every time, you know, you go out for that walk or you sit in your garden, we always thought, well, they're probably okay. It's the rarer species that are in difficulty. But what another scheme in the centre, the All-Ireland Bumblebee Monitoring Scheme, has shown us is that those really common species are also in difficulty. So really what's happening is rare species are disappearing because they're losing, you know, the habitats that they're dependent on. But everything else is disappearing because the way we're managing the landscape. So that was happening in the centre. At the same time, you know, in universities, and particularly in Trinity College Dublin with Professor Jean Stout, you know, they were researching why pollinators were disappearing and what we could do about it. So I suppose Jean and I came together, you know, back in 2014 and said, you know, we know what's happening. We know what we could do. We either just keep watching this problem happen, or we try to do something about it. And so that's where the All-Ireland Pollinator Plan came from. So Jean and I put together the initial draft, and we called a steering group with representatives, you know, from across the island who could come together to try and address this issue. And we published the All-Ireland Pollinator Plan in 2015. And the book that you mentioned now is sort of a celebration of everything that we've achieved through that plan over the last 5 years. And I suppose in terms of joining those dots, the whole focus of the All-Ireland Pollinator Plan was about looking at our whole landscape, you know, whether, and I always say everyone can help with this, whether you have a window box or a farm or a park or whatever it is, everyone can help if you have some responsibility for some piece of land. So really that's what the Pollinator Plan was about. It was looking about the entire Irish landscape and saying, can we make farmland more pollinator friendly? Can we make public land more pollinator friendly? And can we make private land more pollinator friendly? Bees are in huge difficulties, there's no doubt about that, as are other wild pollinators. But, you know, we don't have to accept that fate. We can solve this problem, you know, but it involves us all coming together. And that's what the All-Ireland Pollinator Plan, you know, has tried to do and continues to try to do.
And what's the consequence of accepting that fate?
I get asked this, in some ways, it's a frightening, you know, consequence. Bees are important for a number of different reasons. They're important for the farmers and growers who depend on them. You know, we know that the free service provided by bees is worth up to $59 million a year to the Irish economy. The frightening part of that is that both in Ireland and elsewhere, we're trying to grow more and more pollinator-dependent crops all the time. And at the same time, the pollinators themselves are disappearing. So that's a consequence. The other one is pollinators are really important for our own health and well-being. You know, so without pollinators, we wouldn't starve. But it'll be very hard to have a healthy, balanced diet because it's the fruit and vegetables that they're pollinating. And, you know, for generation upon generation, we would have grown our own fruit and vegetables in Ireland. You know, our grandparents and great-great-grandparents did that. We have moved away from it a wee bit. But, you know, I feel really strongly that we shouldn't lose our ability to do that in the future. You know, so that's something that we really have to strongly protect. And the third huge reason is that pollinators don't just pollinate the crops and the fruits and vegetables, they also pollinate over 3/4 of all the wild plants in the landscape. So without pollinators, the landscape looks totally different. It's a lot less colourful, a lot less attractive. You know, those wild plants provide fruits and seeds for birds and mammals. They provide shelter for other insects and animals. So really, pollinators are crucial, crucial to the health of the whole environment.
And what I'm hearing from you is that this isn't part of a natural cycle where things are dying out. It's human intervention and things that we're doing that is upsetting the balance of our environment.
That's it in a nutshell. Yeah, you know, obviously, of course, things cycle in and out, and that would be natural. What we're seeing now is not natural. And over the last 40 years, what we're seeing is pollinator populations being decimated because of the way that we're managing the landscape. Some of that, you know, is a consequence of change in farming practice. And, you know, in that case, it's about just creating a new balance that works for everyone. And some of it is just the way that we've become accustomed to managing the landscape. You know, we've become obsessed with neat and tidiness. And, you know, there's a place for that. But I suppose we've taken it to extremes in some ways, and that we now manage a lot of the landscape in this really neat and tidy way. And, you know, you can do that, but it has consequences. And one of the consequences is that you squeeze nature out and you risk losing these vital services that it provides, like pollination.
I suppose, in a way, if you want to see how serious all of this is, you can just look at the four partners that are involved in the All-Ireland Pollinator Plan. It's the Heritage Council, Biodiversity Ireland, Bord Bia Irish Food Board, and the Department of Agriculture, Food and the Marine. So there's a big hint as to how big the stakes are when you see the level of involvement and the nature of the different organizations that are involved in this program. I read the report and I could see that farmland accounts for 65% of the landmass in Ireland. So it goes without saying that farmers and how they look after their land, they can play a colossal role in addressing some of these issues. And I know later in this podcast episode, we're going to be chatting to one particular farmer, John Fogarty. He's based in the Horse and Jockey in Tipperary. He's a dairy farmer. But you know him, don't you? And I think you've been doing a little bit of work with him along the way. Could you tell me about that?
Yeah, John's amazing, and he's been so supportive of the Pollinator Plan. And I've known John for a long, long time because he's developed an interest in really in all biodiversity and wildlife, and, you know, he's engaged a lot with the National Biodiversity Data Centre. I think coming back to your original points when you were saying, you know, 65% of the Irish landscape is farmed, and farmers are absolutely crucial to the success of the All-Ireland Pollinator Plan. And they've been amazing. You know, where we've engaged with farmers, they've just been so supportive. And what we've always tried to do is to say, you know, any farm, regardless of type or intensity level, can become more pollinator friendly, you know, by taking small actions just to create food and shelter and safety for pollinators back on the farm. And often it's really simple things like, you know, not cutting your hedgerows so often so that it gets to flower in May. You know, Ireland, we have the most amazing hedgerows in Ireland. Sometimes we take it for granted because not all countries have that. But you know yourself, sometimes, you know, you're out traveling around the country in May and you see these gorgeous, you know, white corridors stretching across farmland. Those are so important for biodiversity, for pollinators, really for all biodiversity. And it's just really about managing that in a way. And John, you know, couldn't epitomize any better that, you know, John understands hedgerows, he understands how to manage them, and he appreciates, you know, the beauty of them and the value of them, both for wildlife and also for the farm. So, yeah, you know, farmers have been fantastic. And as I say, what we've tried to do in the first phase of the plan is do quite a bit of groundwork just to identify the best ways to engage with farmers. Farmers, they're amazing, but they want to be told what to do and they want to be given the right advice. You know, and I suppose that's really what we've been trying to focus on. And we do have a big project within the National Biodiversity Data Centre called Protecting Farmland Pollinators. We're working with a group of 40 farmers based in Kildare. And just showing that you can, regardless, as I say, of your farm type or your intensity level, you can make your farm more pollinator friendly. So, you know, simple actions can make all the difference in farmland, as is the case, you know, with every sector.
Yeah, and of course, the farmers get beaten up an awful lot about carbon emissions and everything, but a bit of education, they can play a huge role in reversing this trend.
They can, and they already do. And I suppose that's, I suppose, something that we want to always try and emphasize more. Farmers are already doing really positive stuff, you know, and it's about flagging that, giving them credit for that. And then, you know, moving on that journey and saying, well, you could also do this, this, and this. And, you know, I suppose that's what we've been trying to do within the pollinator plan.
And are you managing to reach the farming community in Ireland?
I think so. And say, you know, we're at the start of this journey, and with particularly with farmers, what we wanted to do was put in the groundwork in the first phase so that we knew exactly how to progress it in the most effective way, mainly for farmers, if we're honest. So, yeah, you know, the farming associations, Department of Agriculture, everyone's been incredibly supportive. You know, when we reach farmers themselves, you know, they're really engaged. I suppose in some ways we're blessed that this is a pollinator plan. You know, people like bees, they connect with them. They know why they're important. I always think if it was the All-Ireland Snail Plan or something, you know, it'd be a totally different caliber. But, you know, people like bees. You know, they remember. Often people have memories of, you know, hearing hedgerows buzzing in the past, and, you know, and they want to get back to that.
And I know in the first phase there were 81 actions as part of that plan. And maybe we've ticked a big box on the farming one, and I know it's such a big issue. Could you give me an example of some of the other actions and maybe demonstrating the difference all of us can make, be it professionally or, you know, through our councils and us as individuals?
Yeah, so what we've tried to do within the plan is it's a call to action to everybody. And in some ways, the beauty of this is that no one has to do a lot, but lots and lots of us have to do a wee bit. So if we all did a little bit, together we'd solve this problem. So what we've tried to do within the pollinator plan is to identify evidence-based actions. So these are things that the science tells us will actually work. So evidence-based actions for different sectors. And what we've done over the last 5 years is publish these for lots and lots of different sectors. You know, so there's one for councils, and it's got 30-odd actions that a council can take to make a difference. We've got one for businesses, you know, so what a business can do. We've got one for local communities, we've got one for gardens, you know, we've got one for transport authorities and so on and so on. So what we've tried to do for each sector is show people and give them a choice of actions. And often they're simple, low cost actions, but actions that you could do to help. As I say, whether that's in your garden or the farm, in a council, in a school, whatever it happens to be. So that's what we've done. And those are all freely available on pollinators.ie. If anyone, you know, wants to go in and have a look, when you go in there, you know, you'll be able to see all the different sectors and you can click on the one that's of relevance to you and see the kind of actions that we're suggesting. So that's what we've done. You know, so we deliberately made this decision to have these tailored evidence-based actions that were written for different sectors to hopefully make as easy as possible for people to get involved.
And the schools is an important one, because that's when you create awareness, and kids are like sponges, aren't they? They'll devour any information you give them.
Exactly. Yeah. And actually that was the very first one So we published the All-Ireland Pollinator Plan back in September, and I really wanted to do a junior plan then after that. And actually the Heritage Council were incredibly supportive at the time. So we did a junior pollinator plan, which was the exact same plan, but written for children. So that was the very first thing that we published, you know, off the back of the plan coming out. And then obviously we followed that up with, you know, guidelines for the different sectors. So absolutely, we've had great success, you know, in reaching school kids. You're right. You know, they're much better informed than most of us at this stage. And I think the future's in safe hands, but the frightening thing, and that to me that's a really, really important point, is that what we do all the time is create these new normals. So like if I think back to my childhood, there were lots of bumblebees. You know, I remember going out in the garden and, you know, there were bumblebees and butterflies everywhere. That to me was normal. What's normal to my children now is something totally different. You know, so they have no comprehension of what's being lost. So they don't feel any onus, or they don't feel that's the emergency to protect it. And I think this has been lost on our watch. We know what's been lost. So it's up to us to try to, you know, address this and solve it. You can't keep relying on future generations if they have no comprehension of what it is that this, what that we have lost. So, you know, I think, you know, there's a huge urgency to this problem, because that new normal thing, you know, continues all the time and can make the problem more difficult to address.
Yeah, so that's us as individuals living our lives. And I guess John Fogarty and the farming community generally, they're in exactly the same way, because that younger generation of farmers just won't realise. So in a way, Una, when we look back at how things were through rose-tinted glasses, imagining something that wasn't there, that's actually not quite the truth. It was different and it was beautiful, and there were smells and there were creatures and it was a better environment. And we've done a lot of things to upset that. The role of the Heritage Council from your point of view and how it's contributed in the 5 years, could you chat to me about that?
Yeah, of course. So the National Biodiversity Data Centre is a programme of the Heritage Council, and the Pollinator Plan is coordinated by the National Biodiversity Data Centre. So obviously, you know, the Heritage Council have provided that level of support. Outside that, they've been incredibly supportive. I would have to give huge credit to the, you know, the Heritage and Biodiversity Officer Network. They really have got behind the plan on every level and across all sectors, you know, so they came up with a special pollinator award in the Tidy Towns competition, for example, which has just, you know, had an incredible impact. And actually the kind of things that communities have done, and, you know, the likes of Ballincollig, where you mentioned, all these, there's 160 now local Tidy Towns groups that have entered that special pollinator award. You know, and they've just done the most amazing things within the local area to make them more pollinator, more biodiversity friendly, you know, and that's a huge change from, you know, where that competition was, I think, you know, 10 or 15 years ago. And for me, one of the best things is that some of the towns that do really well in the pollinator award also do really well in Tidy Towns itself, you know, so just because, you know, you're embracing biodiversity doesn't mean, you know, that things are going wild. It just means that you're creating this new balance that works better for everyone.
Now, you mentioned the Heritage Officers, the network. So there's pretty much someone in every county, I think, is there?
Yeah, pretty much each local authority has a Heritage Officer with that network, then coordinated by the Heritage Council. And as I say, really, they've been incredible. You know, they've been on the ground supporting the All-Ireland Pollinator Plan right from the start and, you know, making things happen. It's easy to say, well, here's what you should do. You know, what you need are local champions in a way to say, okay, here's how we're going to make that happen. And, you know, and that's exactly what they've done. And really, as I say, you know, full credit to them. You know, they've been instrumental in the success of the All-Ireland Pollinator Plan.
And Una, the next phase of the plan?
Yeah, we're really excited. So the first phase, you know, as you mentioned, the 81 actions in the first plan, you know, they've pretty much been delivered. So what we've done is come together as a steering group to produce a new, more ambitious plan for the next 5-year phase. So that will run 2021 to 25. It'll be published in March. We've pushed ahead. So I hope, you know, I'll say, you know, that this problem was probably 40 years in the making. We've put in a really good start over the last 5 years, but we have to continue that. And so, you know, we're excited about this new plan. It is more ambitious than the first one. There's a lot more actions next time around. Want to engage, you know, more with sectors that are already contributing, identify new sectors that can help and, you know, really address this problem. You know, if we all come together, we can solve this.
You're raising the bar again.
Yes, definitely, definitely.
And the thing is, there's a huge goal here. There's a benefit to everyone if we go after this properly.
there's a massive benefit to everyone. You know, you in helping pollinators, we're helping ourselves. We know how important nature is to us. I think, you know, increasingly so, both for the services it provides, but also for our own health and well-being. You know, I think we saw that during this COVID crisis, people have connected with nature again. You know, they understand how important it is to them. And they understand just, you know, the beauty of being able to get out into a garden that's buzzing with life, or into a park, you know, or into a wood or whatever. So, you know, I think we all know how important nature is to us. We know the impact that we're having on it. We know how to change it. So let's just do that, you know, get behind the pollinator plan and make a change.
In the current climate, it would be nice if we could be reminded that a new normal can be a beautiful, healthier place for everyone. And through your fantastic work at the National Biodiversity Data Centre, and of course, with the help of the Heritage Council, we can all enjoy that and our children. Dr. Una Fitzpatrick, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Thank you.
In the next segment of this podcast, we chat with Lorcan Scott, the Wildlife Officer with the Heritage Council, about his work, where the Heritage Council tie in with the Heritage Officer Network, and the other actions and initiatives that are supported throughout the country for biodiversity. Lorcan Scott, Wildlife Officer for the Heritage Council, welcome to the Heritage Council podcast.
Thank you, Greg.
We've heard from Una, and she was talking about the All-Ireland Pollinator Plan. And of course, like anything else, that plan has 81 actions, and
yes,
it remains a plan until those actions start happening.
Yeah, yeah.
Could you join the dots a little bit for me and maybe explain your role and how that comes to life, you know, through the Heritage Council and the Heritage Officer Network, and how we can see a lot of these initiatives literally happening in our neighbourhoods?
Okay, well, the Heritage Council, well, first of all, you know, we're significant funders of the National Biodiversity Data Centre, and Una and her work there in with the All-Ireland Pollinator Plan is driving strategies, you know, for the Heritage Council, also for the Department of Housing, Local Government and Heritage. So at the higher level, we come up with these strategies. We know that these strategies are drawn up to address problems that are in the wider countryside. The government have declared a climate and biodiversity crisis. So what sort of actions will we do to address these? And policies are drawn up so that, you know, we should be kinder on the environment and that. And the All-Ireland Pollinator Plan is a response to that. The 81 actions contained in it are there to get the... Pollinators are one of the major foundation blocks for a healthy ecosystem. If we get that right, there is food then for the birds that people want to protect and conserve, and some of the mammals that might feed on them. So it's all interconnected. And the Heritage Council try and make that strategy come alive through actions like supporting the All-Ireland Pollinator Plan, the Biodiversity Data Centre, and getting the data that supports all that. And then we also have other programmes like the Heritage Officer Network. The Heritage Council subsidises the role of Heritage Officer around the local authorities. Also work with biodiversity officers there as well. And we would have funding schemes that would drive some of the actions that they would put into their local authority heritage or biodiversity action plan. So at all levels, we're trying to get the reach out to communities. We would have a community grant scheme most years where people who want to do actions that are covered in the All-Ireland Pollinator Plan, we can support some of them at times.
And when it comes to those actions you were saying in March, there's going to be a call out to communities, is there?
Yes, in 2021, we hope to have a call out at some time in March. It hasn't been decided finally as yet, so that local communities can make a submission to get supported for some of the actions that they want to deliver for their local community.
And what kind of projects typically would fall into those categories?
Sure. Well, in the past, we have supported programs like removing invasive species. Some communities would have, some of their rivers might be damaged by Himalayan balsam or Japanese knotweed. And through the heritage officers, where it can be shown that it's driving the wider policy in a local area, that we would try and support funding to pay for some of the equipment needed to eradicate those. Also then we would have some interpretation material supported where they're raising awareness of some of the issues of an important area in their local community. It might be interpretive boards or it might be a publication. they'd be very typical projects.
Okay. I noticed as well in some of the things we discussed earlier that there's a Tidy Towns Local Authority Pollinator Award.
Yeah, so the heritage officers pooled together and could see that, first of all, it's something that's very popular with local Tidy Town groups. These are the people that can make a real difference, a real impact throughout the country. And they wanted to guide them, so they produced material that would raise awareness about best practice in relation to pollination actions. It's not a case that every area that you will improve it by turning it into a pollinator meadow. It might be an important wetland and it might be species poor, but it could be a very important breeding habitat for newts or something. So we didn't want to lose the very rich areas that we have already. So they needed a bit of guidance and they came together and decided to buy into the Tidy Towns competition, the national competition. And they give awards then to local communities who have demonstrated best practice in relation to the pollinator action plan.
And it's clever doing something like introducing a competitive element.
Well, there's competitive nature in all of us. And certainly when it comes to GAA or Tidy Town groups, it's your neighbours aren't your neighbours unless you're in the parish, I'm sure.
But you're helping to guide people towards the things that are important.
Yeah, so they have. They've produced material. They've highlighted projects that are exemplary in terms of work that they've done already. It's very simple. You know, it might be doing less, spending less money on herbicides. It might be just augmenting their mowing regime so that they're cutting an area like people would have done for old hay meadows once a year. Or it might be getting involved in citizen science and doing a bumblebee survey, or maybe just creating an earthen bank where solitary bees can hibernate in that. So very small, but all having an impact and all very important.
In the conversation we were having earlier, it was that 55% of the councils are kind of signed up to the pollinator plan.
They've adopted the All-Ireland pollinator plan as policy, you know, for their county, that they will try and drive the actions, the 81 actions in that plan. So that's fantastic to see. And I believe more will follow too.
And how would Joe Public witness that in their own towns and cities?
The All-Ireland Pollinator Plan is 5 years now. So we're celebrating that with the publication. And I think, you know, if you're driving around the country in any significant way at all, you will see some of the signage up to say that this area has been managed for wildlife. You will see areas that are, you know, obviously been left not unkept, but uncut to allow, you know, seed of wildflowers to establish and the pollinators. And, you know, there's a general awareness among children, especially, you know, in schools, that they're bringing home these messages to people. So I think in a range of areas, it's quite noticeable, really.
And I'm glad you mentioned schools, because there's a schools program as well.
There is. The Heritage Council support they drive the Heritage and Schools program. It's a somewhere where schools around the country can apply for funding to bring an expert into their school. It might be an archaeologist in relation to educating the children about the importance of their local heritage. It might be a ruin of a church or the old cemetery and the history in their local area. But often too, we support ecologists going into classrooms. It's part classroom based and part outdoor based. And they get an opportunity to get down and dirty with some of the bugs that are in and around their school, or maybe it's their local park or a woodland or something like that. So they can see how it all fits into their life.
Yeah, and of course, they're our future and getting in there early.
They're buy and sell you too. They're sponges now. They're fantastic.
Yeah, exactly. And it's really interesting. And on this topic overall, as a general householder, can I play my own part in contributing to this huge agenda?
Oh, very much so. So even in choices in your garden plants, you know, you can get plants that are better for pollinators. They tend to be our native species. Not always so. You know, most people know the butterfly bush, Buddleia, which isn't native by any means, but, you know, it can be a huge contributor to drawing in insects for pollinator. Contorni aster, be another one like that. But where you can, we look for the native species. And that maybe even just a part of your lawn maybe around to leave a wider, rougher area that wildflowers get a chance to set seed and that. And that all, you know, it's the power of the many. It isn't just the few being expert at a particular policy. It's the spread of that and the built up contribution that everyone has around the country. That's what will make the difference.
And simple things like hedge cutting and grass cutting. You're telling me now that I have a good excuse to say to herself, no, it's better for everything if I leave it another week.
I might be guilty in that department for sure. More than a week, you'll get 3 or 4 or 5 weeks rest now if you're doing this. So, you know, it isn't that you are not managing it. It's that the methodology you use to manage it is just a little bit kinder. So when it is cut, you can certainly keep it. Once the seed has fallen, there's no reason why you can't be cutting the area. So yeah, again, the hedgerow side of it, it isn't that they wouldn't be cut at all. They're not going wild, but you have a 2 or 3 year regime rather than them being cut every year.
Yeah. So a piece of advice though might be, don't be too obsessed with neat and tidy. Let things grow a little bit naturally.
And again, by doing so, you know, it's a bit more interesting. You know, it will draw in insects and you'll get perfumes that you haven't had in a while. And it's really empowering to have an area that is so productive rather than neat and tidy. And there are areas that should be neat and tidy. I had a couple of hurly mad kids now, so they run around the garden and they wouldn't want to be using the ball in deep meadow most of the time. So there's an area where it's sensible to keep it cut low. That's what we do. And other areas then we set aside for pollinators.
Well, Lorcan, you're after giving me the expertise that I can quote the next time I want to dodge grass cutting or hedge cutting. Lorcan, thanks a million for coming on the Heritage Council podcast.
Thank you.
In the last segment of this podcast, we chat with dairy farmer John Fogarty about the importance of hedgerows and cutting back on pesticides to pollinators, and how making small changes can make such a big difference to biodiversity on his farm in Tipperary. I'm joined on the Heritage Council podcast by John Fogarty, a dairy farmer in Tipperary. What part of Tipper are you from, John?
Horse and Jockey.
We know it well.
Good. Yeah, it's a famous stopping-off spot for a lot of people on their way up and down the country.
Early in my conversation, I was talking to Dr. Una Fitzpatrick from the National Biodiversity Data Centre. And we were chatting about the All-Ireland Pollinator Plan. And of course, we know that 65% of the landscape in Ireland is farmland. So obviously, farmers like yourself play a huge role in achieving some of the things in the Pollinator Plan. And I know you've been working closely with her on a few initiatives, and hedgerows being the number one big ticket item on that plan. Could you chat to me about hedgerows, John, and some of the interesting things you were saying to me about maybe some of the other younger farmers who mightn't even know what normal looks like?
Well, hedgerows have changed immensely over the last 50 years. In the early 70s, when we joined the EU, we were actually paid to take out hedgerows because it made the fields bigger. And the next thing then was trying to save hay, and that hedgerows were too high and they needed to cut them down to make fodder for the winter. It's hard to dry grass if the hedges are high. So hedges would have been usually cut with a saw, and every 7 or 8 years, and some of the material would be taken for firing and the rest of it would be disposed of. But the flail mower came in then, and it became much easier to trim a hedge down to a standard size, and there was no cleaning up to be done after it. And people started to do this every year. So a lot of trees actually flower on 2-year-old wood. So they've lost the ability basically to flower and set seed. And if they don't flower, they're not there for the pollinators. And if they don't set seed, there's no food for the birds or the insects that follow on. So I think the hedgerows are hugely important. And I think a hedgerow in the autumn, well, in the spring, in April and May, when they're in flower, they can be absolutely fabulous. A large white thorn hedge or black thorn passed by a crab apple on it, and the scent of it is absolutely fabulous. And then you go to the autumn and all the berries in the different colours, your blacks and blues and reds and oranges. A spindle tree is like it's on fire in the autumn if you're lucky enough to have one. And again, it leaves all that food for the birds to overwinter. And all that has been taken away. Hedgerows just kind of got neglected. Well, I won't say they got neglected, but they were abandoned. People really didn't know the value that they had to other parts of the environment, biodiversity, birds, insects, or even small mammals, whatever you want. But we just lost that. And I think we're 50 years down the road now, and I don't think the younger generation even know what an old hedgerow would look like. They're all a standard 5 or 6 foot high, trimmed into a square once a year, and that's the way it's done, and they don't really know any better. And I think we have to kind of go back and get people back into leaving them alone. Maybe do a bit more rotational cutting. If you left a hedge alone even for 3 years, it would get a chance to flower and set seed at least once every 3 years. You'd increase production for flowers and everything 30% straight away. There's no doubt about it. I don't think it would cost that. You definitely wouldn't be an extra cost anyway. I don't know if you save anything, but I don't think it would be a cost. So that's basically my thinking on the hedgerows.
You can obviously see how it happened. A bit of technology has come in.
Yes.
To make the job a little bit easier for the very busy farmer.
Correct, yes.
They're trying to keep an eye on their overhead and their time as well. Time is money, as they say. So how long has this become a norm, you know, in an Irish context?
Probably started in the mid-70s. Farmers just got, the fields just needed to get bigger for the size of the machinery. It was all down to mechanization. And of course, if you're driving along a hedge and you lose a mirror to a mirror of a tractor, it's 80 or 90 euros now if you lose a mirror. So you can't be afforded to do that either, and narrow little lanes and down the side of the road. And people are giving out that the farmer won't cut his hedges because they're leaning out over a road or they're getting their car scratched. But I can understand along a road, that's a safety issue. But in around the field, we could definitely pare back a little bit on the amount of work we're doing.
Yeah, and I think we've become a very neat society as well. Everything has to be neat and tidy everywhere.
Yes, it has. That's the way it has been done, and that's the way it has to be done. We don't really know. And it is the simplest. There's no doubt about it. You can ring a contractor to come with a flail, and you can do your whole farm there in a couple of days or a day or two, and it's done for the year. I suppose it's just that simple. And you don't even have to go out in the field. You know, he knows what he's to do because it's a standard. It's this height and this width, and that's it. There's no thinking at all involved in it. It's as simple as that.
I know in the conversation we were having earlier that you seem to have a good sense that what we were doing was wrong. Did you have that yourself when you were using the flail, as you were talking about it, that this is disrupting in a way that it shouldn't be? Did you get that sense before we had all the information that we have now about those things?
I think we all probably sensed it, but we all thought they'll be all right, they'd go somewhere else, but they have nowhere else to go now because we're all doing this, if you understand me. I mean, maybe I might cut my hedges, but my neighbour mightn't have had. So I'd say, well, should they go over there and they'll be okay for this year. The birds now, I don't think anyone even considered insects as part of an important part of the biodiversity. In most papers, insects were just a nuisance to us all, like they were in your face when you didn't want them. But when I started doing the bumblebee transects, for instance, the first thing I noticed, and it was very quickly, I noticed that you basically walk a path once a month and count how many bumblebees and bees you'd see on that path. And I noticed straight away, once I went out of my garden, out to my farm, if I went out where I was more intensively farming, the number of bees just dropped to nothing. And again, if you come to a field then where perhaps I was going cutting hay or something, but there was more flowers, the numbers would pick up. I'd come back out along my public road, the bee numbers would pick up again because they had the flowers and they had nourishment and they had shelter. And then I'd go into, there's a bog across the road from me. I had, part of my transect was to go in there. And of course, that would be full of them because there was nothing threatening them in terms of interfering with their habitat. But it very quickly became obvious that farmers were having an impact. I mean, I could see them, as I said to you, I was doing the butterfly transect on the same path. And the same thing with the butterflies. They wouldn't be in the fields with the grass because there was nothing there for them in terms of food or nourishment. They needed the flowers.
Could you talk to me briefly about the butterfly monitoring you were doing?
In 2009, I just went in there was a small open day down the road here, and I went down to it, and Dr. Mike Monzel from TRBDI in Torres was giving the talk, and he was explaining about how they were doing a thing called butterfly monitoring to monitor climate change, and basically to see if climate was changing, butterflies might fly a little earlier or a little later, or some of them mightn't survive at all because the temperatures mightn't be quite right or they'd be too wet. So you basically walk a kilometer of a path and you divide it up into segments, let's say 100 meters long, and you'd count every butterfly, every species of butterfly that you'd see. And then year on year, you'd compare what you had seen Were they flying a little earlier? Were they flying a little later? And I've been doing, well, I haven't done it for the last year or two, but 2009 I started. But you could even see within the 10 years there that there was little changes. The wet years, some species of butterfly would be very poor because they couldn't fly. And again, as I said, on the farm, for instance, the council flailed both sides of the road. And that used to be my best part of my transect. But for that year, it was very low because they just didn't have any flowers. So there was nothing drawing them in. And I suppose that's basically how it works.
And that problem, so John, can be solved by, instead of cutting every year, that you just rotate every 2 or 3 years?
I would say every 3 years. That if you rotate it every 3 years, it would give things a chance to flower and set seed. And I think that would be the simplest way. That would be the simplest. And also, just mind the fertilizers and the chemicals. Another thing farmers seem to do is spray under electric fences to stop higher vegetation, such as thistles and nettles and ragwort. But they're good plants for providing nectar to bees and pollen. So if you just cut back a little bit on the chemicals as well, maybe trim under them instead, you could save another little bit of habitat.
Yeah, and of course the herbicides then is another time-saving device for a busy
farmer. Yes.
So you can understand how and why they might be doing that. And you obviously are very tuned into the environment and you've a big conscience about it. And you obviously have the benefit of remembering a time when you had busy hedgerows with lots of flowers and lots of bees. And I know as well, I read a little piece that you had written and you were talking about the benefits of all of that, as well as being beautiful to look at, but also that there's wind protection to the animals and to some of the farm buildings, so that there's loads of advantages to doing that rotation.
Yes, shelter would be very important. There'd be shelter for farmyards and for animals. And I think there's also an element of privacy too. And also, even if you're only spreading slurry or something, that keeps the smell down, if it just stops it from blowing around. No, seriously, it is a fact. And noise, like, you know, as I said to some, I think just when Juanita Brown was down with me, I'm about 11 miles from Turles, and I can virtually read the clock of the cathedral in Turles from my backyard at the moment. As a child, you wouldn't even know where Turles was with the hedges because you couldn't see it, but it is clear all the way to Turles now, basically. All the hedges are mowed down. It's sad in a way. We just didn't realize we're doing it because we're all doing our own little bit. It's just kind of a death of a thousand cuts. Everyone does their own little bit. And when you get it small and tidy and manageable, you tend to keep it that way. Yeah. And it just needs to be given a little bit of space to do its own thing.
And what I get from you, and that's the point I was trying to make, is that you've got a reference point. You remember how it was. And you were saying a lot of the young generation of farmers coming through now have no reference point because it's always been the way it is right now. There's a new normal,
yes.
I suppose.
Yeah.
So within the farming community, do you see more of that young generation who are environmentally conscious and all of that? Do you see them coming on board a little bit more with this new way of thinking and a new way of doing things?
I don't know. I think they're conscious of it, but I'm not too sure would they actually make the leap to actually changing. I'm sorry to say that now, but that's my thinking. They're just too busy. And realistically, they're just too busy to... Now, some of them will plant a few trees and that, and it all adds up. But I just think they're too busy. There's competition for their time the whole time to be doing something else. You have to move cattle or dose cattle or do a bit of fencing or save hay or silage or clean out a shed. There's always something. You're never idle. And I think that takes off their workload is what they'll be going for. So I think leaving the hedge, I don't know. Maybe they will. I don't know. Yeah. Now, funnily enough, if I do meet farmers, and I have met fellows, if I may just give you a short example, there's a moth called the small egger, and it lays its eggs on blackthorn, and they form a huge, big, like a football of a web. And now I have seen those in the hedges, but they're very rare. They're mainly concentrated in Clare and Donegal, I think. But we found a few of them down around us here. And I just pointed out to one of the local contractors, not my contractor, that was there. And over the next couple of weeks, he rang me anytime he saw one, just to tell me where it was. And all he did was he lifted the flail and went over it. He didn't go through it, because if he went through it, there'd be hundreds of the minute, but they'd all be trashed. So I think it's an awareness, maybe a little bit of education could go a long way. It's only a matter of drawing people's attention to it. As you said, it's the way things have always have been done. And it just needs... And you need to just say, why was it done that way? What was done before? Could we do something a little different? I think it would be a big benefit if we could do things a little different. Just think about what we're doing. That's the big one.
Yeah, and with your knowledge of the farming community, and as we enter the next 5 years of the plan, do you think there's an opportunity there around education? And
there is a lot of work being done. You have the Bride project down in Cork, which is Donald Skeen. That's doing excellent work. I think there's some work in Kildare and Kilkenny through the pollinator project. And it'll all come together eventually about planting trees. And of course, then you have the odd other agencies as well, the Tidy Towns, the group water schemes, all those things coming in. And they're all contributing their own bit of knowledge. And if people that are involved in those things might just bring something home to their own plot of ground as well. And it will all add up. I would be hoping, I suppose the dairy industry and the meat industry are trying to portray themselves as being more environmentally friendly. And they do want you, when you do your Board B audits every 18 months, they do want you to show what you've been doing for the environment. And if that became a little bit more, I suppose, of a winner, people might do a little bit more. There is a change, but it's very slow. But it will come, I presume it will come. We'll have to see.
Yeah, and I guess in the same way that you can have death by a thousand cuts, maybe you can have huge improvement by little improvements.
If everybody only planted one apple tree or left something 100 metres of a hedge alone, for instance, I am on the last scheme there, you were paid to put in banks of sand and bee boxes. Well, they may work. I have bought them. I haven't seen any bees in the sand, and I don't know anyone that has. But like, if you had been paid to leave 100 metres of hedge alone, it would have had an immediate benefit and it would have been obvious. We just have to think about things a little bit different. Do things because it's the right thing to do, not because you're being paid to do it. That would be my theory on it anyway.
John, I think that's a good theory.
Yeah. Well, sure, it was always the way. Simple as that, wasn't it?
And before I leave it go, John, you were mentioning to me when we were chatting earlier about some work you were doing around the Group Water Scheme.
Yes, I was chairman of Ash Hill Group Water Scheme near the Horse and Jockey for nearly 30 years. And in 2018 or 19, I'm not sure off the top of my head now, we decided to do some work around the pump house. Like, you're not really going to be using chemicals or sprays around your water source for your community. So we decided to plant some apple trees and some flowering shrubs, willow, American currant. They were the main ones, Cotoni Aster. And Tipperary County Council Water Services Section with Trina Collins and Adrian Smith of the National Federation of Group Water Scheme came on board with the idea. They've subsequently, Federation of Group Water Schemes have joined the pollinator project plan. And up and down the country now, there are lots of group water schemes monitoring, well, I won't say monitoring the bees, but they've modified the way they maintain the areas around their pump houses and their reservoirs. Some of them have hired ecologists. Some of the sites will be quite small. Some of them will be very, very big. That have there's one in Wexford has 80 acres. And they're doing less mowing around the place now. They've planted some trees. And a lot of these things have also been brought home to those people's own homes, to their farms. And the schools have also become involved because they've come and they've planted the trees. They've also seen where their water is coming from. And I think having a healthy environment around where your water source is a great idea, like, you know, and it just worked out very well.
Yeah. And what this sounds to me, John, is that once you get your thinking right about some of these things, the opportunities open up everywhere.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. It's not rocket science. It's basically just doing the right thing at the right time. And if you're lucky enough to be there when something is starting, then you can just get the right word in, you can make a big difference.
So if we're passing the horse and jockey at any point, is the kettle always on, is it?
Well, the kettle is always on, and you'll be always well looked after down there, no doubt about it.
John, thank you so much for coming on the Heritage Council podcast. I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Greg.
You're so welcome. Cheers. Thank you for listening to the Heritage Council podcast. For more information about our projects and programs, our work with others and our publications, please check our website, heritagecouncil.ie. Follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram or LinkedIn, or subscribe to our YouTube channel. See you again soon.